Hard times create strong men. Strong men create good times. Good times create weak men. Weak men create hard times. Giacomo Zucco's Bitcoin and the Hopf Cycle of the Internet. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know, and we are getting back into the Bitcoin Times Volume 3 from Alexander Svetsky and the team over at Amber. The Bitcoin Times is a wonderful publication. We've done so much from Volume 1 and 2 on this show. And a couple now already from Volume 3. Today's piece is by Giacomo Zucco, and it's really good, and I love this idea. It's taking just a really cool concept in evolution and social patterns and applying it to technology and the history of the internet. We will get into it in just a second. Quick thank you to our sponsors. We have got the BitBox Secure Hardware Wallet. If you've been here for any length of time, your savings probably just quadrupled in value. You got to get a good hardware wallet. BitBox is it. And if you want to go full on Bitcoin and do banking services with Bitcoin and want an exchange that has no trading fees, Levvl.co, LVL.co, is exactly that service. You can check them both out at guyswan.com. Either at the front page, or you can go to /bitbox and /Levvl respectively and check out our awesome sponsors. But with that, let's get into today's read, and then we will jump into a really fun guy's take afterward. And this one is titled, Bitcoin and the Hopf Cycle of the Internet by Giacomo Zucco. Hard times create strong men. Strong men create good times. Good times create weak men, and weak men create hard times. An interesting meme has been circulating on the internet over the last few years, at least. The words used for the caption come from the 2018 post-apocalyptic science fiction novel Those Who Remain by G. Michael Hopf. Two of the pictures used actually come from the 1833 to 1836 series of paintings The Course of Empire by Thomas Cole. The meaning of the paintings themselves are very similar to the meaning of the meme, surprisingly, or perhaps unsurprisingly, since many artists, philosophers, and even historians throughout the centuries have expressed the same concept or concepts. Another famous example would be the Strauss-Howe generational theory. Here we have a circular model showing four time periods, starting with the crisis period, characterized as a period of reset and reliance, and then the budding rebirth period following that, then the awakening associated with abundance, and then followed finally by the unraveling associated with complacency and gluttony, which cycles back to the crisis. Indeed, Hopf's phrasing is just the more recent, and possibly more effective to date, expression of some kind of very ancient intuition about a particular kind of social, but possibly even biological, feedback loop, deeply connected with the ideas of natural selection and anti-fragility. Bad times create strong men. Complex systems tend to strengthen when they survive traumatic events, evolutionary bottlenecks, or crises. Strong men create good times. The new level of strength tends to move the system away from the previous stress factors into a no longer traumatic equilibrium. Good times create weak men. The new low-stress equilibrium tends to select for new traits which are not optimized for stress resistance, centralization, specialization, growth, and convenience replace decentralization, redundancy, reparation, and security. Weak men create bad times. The atrophy of some of the system's strength plus the concentration of systemic risks increases the probability of new crises, new traumatic events, and so on. While simple and exact predictions about complex systems are by definition difficult, and while too strict an interpretation of these quote rules tend to denigrate into pseudoscientific models, implausible variants of historicism, cheap moralistic mantras, and unsubstantiated urban legends, it's difficult to deny the fundamental nature of similar feedback loops in a general enough interpretation. Internet memes applied to the internet. It could be interesting to try and apply this model to the internet itself, and see if we can get any suggestion out of it for the technological tools that have been developed during the last half of a century and for the ones that are being developed now, particularly in connection with Bitcoin. Hard times create strong tools. It should be uncontroversial to state that the invention of the TCP/IP protocol suite, with its fundamentally decentralized and, quote, apocalyptic resistant design, was at least partially driven by the adversarial mood caused by the Cold War and the pervasive nuclear scare. Much has been written about the fact that the specific goal of the ARPANET research project was actually different from the survival of the network to the nuclear holocaust. And it's also true, following Bastiat, that, quote, what is seen, in terms of politically driven investments, in the context of government-sponsored programs, hides, quote, what is not seen, in terms of missed opportunities and alternative allocations of the same resources. Translation, it's not impossible that we may actually have a better internet today if the Cold War and the DARPA agency didn't even exist in the first place. Nevertheless, it's clear that the particularly, quote, hard times surrounding the inception of the internet contributed to some of its objective strengths. Strong tools create good times. It's arguably fair to state that the general optimistic mood which characterized the end of the 20th century was at least partially driven by the success of the internet in connecting the world. While most of the reasons for talking about the, quote, end of history were geopolitical in nature, the collapse of the Soviet bloc and the so-called Pax Americana, which was not without its fair share of sanguinary wars, technological tools were also instrumental for the creation of that triumphant exuberance, the commercialization of the internet, following the December 1994 release of a Netscape Navigator and the NSFNet selling all its assets in 1995, generated huge expectations. Soon enough, the entire financial market was cannibalized by the so-called dot-com bubble in the late 90s. The rate of technological and scientific innovation accelerated hugely, and the wave of, quote, internet optimism overflowed from the stock market into culture, literature, art, entertainment, and society in general. Good times create weak tools. With the new millennium, the dot-com bubble finally burst, but the internet was here to stay, changing the world economy and our lives for good. From the ashes of many shameless money grabs, actual technological giants emerged, replacing most consolidated industries at the top of the stock markets and shaping the new economy. But the lazy reliance on convenience and trust and the absence of adversarial thinking contributed to the weakening of the internet infrastructure. Everything became more centralized and trust-based, thus more efficient, but also more fragile. We can find many examples in the tools we use every day. While the SMTP protocol is theoretically still decentralized, most of us now completely depend on services like Gmail. The same goes for ISP concentration, DNS bureaucratization, centralization of localization services, etc. This trend produced even more extreme effects after the, quote, cloud computing revolution, when even big companies, let alone individuals, stopped hosting servers and just began to use a few cloud providers, and after the social network revolution, when most of the world population started to see the mobile apps provided by a few proprietary platforms as, quote, the internet. This process was the result of many individual choices that were, quote, locally rational. Network effects are very strong, especially for services leveraging social networks. And technological centralization makes most services more efficient, fast, cheap, and convenient. Everybody can immediately appreciate these advantages, while the attached costs may only become apparent after many years. It's a matter of what economists call time preference. Weak tools create bad times. This centralization process was not without advantages. A lot of people have access to the internet today, even in the most remote places. Even people who could be considered deeply impoverished have smartphones. Everything is faster, cheaper, and simpler than ever, with more and more features accumulating every year. But all this came with a cost. Centralization usually brings along serious risks of monopolization, corruption, exclusion, and abuses. Indeed, today we are very easily censored, blacklisted, tracked, spied upon, and watched every time we use the internet. The political risk of scary Orwellian drifts is not even theoretical anymore. We really live in a world where crime-exposing journalists like Julian Assange or peaceful e-commerce innovators like Ross Ulbricht are literally imprisoned, often for life, and often employing methods that resemble torture very closely for the way they used the internet. While almost everybody has a smartphone, almost nobody is free to use it in a secure, open, unrestricted, and privacy-preserving way. And most people are excluded from the internet-based commercial and financial infrastructures due to, quote, KYC political restrictions. Lessons for Bitcoin. The circle closed again. Bitcoin, which can be considered the, quote, value layer of the internet, even if it represents in some sense an innovation which is way deeper than the internet itself, has been created to mitigate and overcome these, quote, hard times made of internet censorship, digital surveillance, financial exclusion, and virtual money manipulation. Bitcoin not only can, but it must learn the lessons that the partial centralization of the internet have taught us, or some of us. By learning from the past, we can avoid similar traps and go a long way toward also helping re-decentralize the whole internet infrastructure again. It could go either way. We could either move to a world where Bitcoin-based permissionless micropayments and Bitcoin-inherited security mindset allow us to create a network of decentralized, trust-minimized, and privacy-respectful systems for storing, transmitting, and computing information. Or we could see Bitcoin getting more and more centralized, intermediated, regulated, manipulated, corrupted, and censored. This means recognizing that there are no panacea solutions, only solutions with inescapable trade-offs. As a result, we need to act accordingly and focus on security, privacy, and verifiability first, over convenience, comfort, quote, user experience, and compliance, which are all nice things to have if and when possible. And this needs to be done at all levels, i.e., as users, as developers, and service providers. From the user point of view, trusting third-party custodians like Mt. Gox instead of bothering to learn private key management is convenient, but fragile. Trusting ASIC production monopolists like Bitmain via SPV clients instead of bothering to run a full validating node is convenient, but fragile. Trusting tax lawyers and security guards to protect us from legal confiscation and casual kidnappings instead of bothering to learn privacy best practices like Tor, CoinJoin, UTXO management, KYC avoidance, etc., is convenient, but fragile. From the developer or provider perspective, trust and centralization are obviously easier to monetize, How do you charge for open source, decentralized, trust minimized protocols? But again, they are fragile. The current relics of good time mindset make it difficult to understand the trade-off. But bad times are coming again to remind us of the price we may pay in the long run for our convenience in the short run. It's time to build strong tools again. By Giacomo Zucco. All right, let's take a quick break and hit our sponsor, and then I want to get into Guy's take on Giacomo's piece, The Hop Cycle of the Internet, and how it applies to Bitcoin, because I think this is a really cool, I think this is kind of an evolutionary principle that can be applied to a lot of things. And I love how he takes this concept and like breaks it down in the history of the internet. And it's actually right along the lines of something I've talked about a lot on the show. I just think this might be a clearer way to think about it. So I want to have that discussion in just a second. But let's hit our sponsor real quick for today's show, and then we will jump right back in. So I've recently had a few people I know personally who invested in Bitcoin just before this major run-up, and they've really been riding a rocket down the rabbit hole. So I was just having a convo with somebody who was just like, I need to run a node. I got to get on Lightning. Do I need a Raspberry Pi computer? What hardware wallet? All this crazy stuff. And I'm like, slow down. The first and most important thing you need to do is secure your savings by holding your keys. You need a secure, easy-to-use hardware wallet. That is the Bitbox O2. It is actually co-founded by a Bitcoin developer, and the team is made up of serious engineers. It is Swiss-made. It's a sleek, simple design. The backup is as simple as plug in your SD card, hit the backup button, take it out. The wallet software is super minimal, and it just works. If you have started investing, get a Bitbox before it turns into a ton of money and keep your Bitcoin safe. Check it out at guyswan.com/bitbox. So the thing I love most about this this mental model, the thing most enlightening about using this to look back on history, is that this pattern shows up everywhere. And Giacomo does such a good job of taking what has been something that's historically been applied to a social phenomenon and shows how this is something that's also true in technology. And I think this makes perfect logical sense. I think this is less a social phenomenon and more an inevitable reality of the evolutionary process. And that's why I think Giacomo is correct in putting this over our technological trends and these much shorter, faster trends that we see in the evolution of innovation and our protocols and these sorts of things. And this is right in line with the analogy that I use a lot on this show in the past, the two steps forward, one step back idea. This is the same thing as the four steps talked about here, except that it's simplified, I guess you could say. We have two steps forward, which is the maturation and prosperity phase caused from the solution to the previous systemic problem. And then eventually that leads to complacency and stagnancy. And then a new stressor or something comes into the environment. A new systemic problem eventually grows to outpace the prosperity or the ability to sustain the previous. And then we have one step back. And suddenly we have a new pressure, we have a new stressor, we have a new vulnerability exposed. So applying this all to evolution, we know that it is under major stressors that evolution gets a kick in the ass. And I think this happens on really small scales all the way up to the scale of billions of years. I think this is one of those things that you can see everywhere. It's just like, you know, hot goes to a cold area and you see a cycle and it creates a swirl. Like you see that in a cup, you see that in a tornado, you see that in a hurricane, you see that in the universe. Like this is something that is fundamental to the way things move and change in the universe and in life. And just as all of the patterns that we see in weather, we can see when we look at just a few molecules and, you know, look at the tiniest or the largest of scales. So when you're looking at, when we're looking at billion year shifts in species on the planet, and then, you know, like looking at how tiny fractions of that time post some major event, you get these Cambrian explosions. You know, there's been like five or six great extinctions, and then subsequently five or six explosions of variety and new evolution. When you look through the history of the world, like for what we know of, at least at this point, new species, new massive variety of life, and a new dominant hierarchy, a new dominant species that changes hands throughout, you know, every couple of billions of years or whatever it is. And this goes down to bacteria on the matter of days or hours. Like, we've evolved bacteria in petri dishes. You know, like you introduce a micro, like you know, you take a bacterial environment or whatever, and here's some bacteria that cannot survive in some specific acid or something like that, or some, you know, specific substance that you introduce into the environment is a huge stressor to the bacteria. So they literally, you know, put a little drop of it. They just put just a little bit of it into the environment, and it kills off a lot of the bacteria. But inevitably, some of them survive, and those reproduce, and they're better sustained, or they're better prepared for this substance. They put another drop in it. And they do this over and over again. Then they start increasing the number of drops. And then eventually, after a period of days and generations of this bacteria, suddenly, seemingly out of nowhere, emerges one variety of this bacteria that eats the substance, that literally survives on this new thing that they've introduced into the environment. And rather than having to resist this thing, evolution has produced something that thrives on it. And then it replaces all of the other bacteria as you continue to introduce the substance into the environment. This pattern is everywhere. And, you know, when a massive stressor is introduced to a stable environment, it causes, you know, death, destruction, damage from this new entrant, and makes new mutations or even old mutations suddenly become important, or suddenly become that thing that was needed but never had the room to actually grow, as the dominant species, the dominant technology, whatever it is, no longer can retain the stability of the food chain, so to speak. So this sends all of the balances that were previously established into disarray. And in this new chaotic environment, suddenly the species, the population, or some technological method, some variation on a gene that was unimportant or never really emerged in the previous cycle while everything was prosperous, can suddenly flourish that simply couldn't under previous conditions. Something will survive the new stressor, something that specifically counters the problem that is caused by this shift in the environment, or this major event, or this new substance that's introduced. One bacteria, maybe it's unimportant when that substance isn't there, but one bacteria will eat it. One bacteria will thrive on it rather than merely survive the damage done. That comes into stable existence, and being the only thing in the environment that now can operate without that stressor being a constant pressure against it, explodes. It flourishes where everything else struggles simply to stay alive. And then that new species or technology is copied. It's varied. It's built on top of. It spreads. It mutates and eventually becomes the dominant force or species or protocol or whatever it is that stretches to the limits of its environment. You know, just like a gas will expand to the size of its container, the dominant pattern, the surviving genes, the strong technology will stretch to the edges of its population, its environment, its world, whatever. This is the bad times create strong men stage. This is the terrible events create strong genes. This is the destructive, vulnerable networks create strong code. And then comes the prosperity. And the absence of those stressors, or now with the ability to ignore the stressor and operate as if it doesn't exist, this newfound security or strength of the adapted species or technology causes a peak. You get generations of wealth, health, and happiness that inevitably lead to complacency. Going back to like the social sphere, suddenly, you know, the population forgets the philosophy of the dark days because those days are over. Why are you guys stuck in the past? That's not our world. It's different now. The genes don't mutate as much. Variations don't have the room to grow because there's nothing pushing the dominant genes out of the way. Why do we need a variation? The dominant ones are doing fine. They have a robust hold on the food chain. They're prosperous and strong. There's no room or need. Those variations may have attributes that survive some major stressor, but without the stressor, who needs them? Much like an encrypted internet at its beginnings, or an encrypted digital money. It's not so important, so it doesn't thrive, because the faster and easier solution will grow quicker. So everybody gets comfortable. The pressure to change is low, but it produces stagnancy in gene selection. It produces a weak culture. It produces men and women who don't know real strife and are weak and dependent. It produces systemic vulnerabilities. For any problem that the adaptation didn't completely solve, and there's no perfect solution to anything, so that's going to be there, inevitably it overcompensated, or for something that didn't matter maybe in the early stages, or it left some tiny vulnerability, maybe like a minor debt imbalance at the beginning stages of a fiat bubble. It's no big deal. It's no big deal. It's only 3%. But 50 years later, it's 400% in a matter of months, because it was a systemic problem. The imbalances build while the variations never catch hold. And eventually, the imbalance comes to fruition. Eventually, a new stressor comes along. Eventually, censorship comes along. A poisonous ideology. A virus. A once-in-a-thousand-year weather event. A solar flare. You name it. Whatever. Suddenly, everything is thrown back into chaos because the technology, the philosophy, the genetic constitution has matured in a stress-free environment, specifically because it created the environment by solving the previous stressor. And thus, it is unprepared for the eventual, inevitable hard times that always come. This is the weak men create hard times stage. This is the weak technology create broken networks and destroyed value and livelihoods. This is the weak genes or weak immune systems create widespread death and sickness. And we go back to the beginning. From this chaos rises the philosophy that nobody listened to. Because why care about deficits or Austrian economics when fiat is in a boom period? Seriously, who's going to listen to that? The genes that were naturally immune to a virus that didn't even yet exist, why would they thrive? The encryption that everybody ignored because their messages had never been censored. The digital money that wasn't needed because Visa payments always went through and the dollar seemed to work just fine and my account had never been frozen. Now, this stage may be where the greatest harm lies and the greatest struggle. And without a doubt, that is where we are right now. But it also creates the greatest opportunity. The asymmetry when the old world, when the old ideologies, when people cling to the idea that the dollar just works fine, and these ideologies, they can't recognize the coming storm before it is directly over top of them. That is where all the opportunity lies. Bitcoin is the new genetic code. It's the new system that has laid in wait for the imbalances of the fiat world to cave in on itself. With a solution ready and waiting. It is that asymmetric bet that so many refuse to understand or even look at because they are still stuck in the, but those things are in the past. This time is different. Infinite prosperity delusion. And what's funny is that this actually takes us back to, this is really the pattern, this is really the key concern in my mind of the block size debate, the very genetic code of Bitcoin. The idea that we can just leave validation up to a few miners or huge institutions and ignore the fact that if we raise the block size to 100 megabytes and let the chain grow to 52 terabytes in just 10 years and say, oh, that's not important, that would immediately give us the next systemic imbalance that we could ultimately do nothing about. We'd let it get away from us at the very beginning, and then it builds until there's nothing we can do about it. When a storm comes and wipes out half the nodes, we could never boot them back up. It becomes harder and harder to validate. It becomes less and less public. It becomes less and less a thing of strength and robustness, rather than easier and easier, stronger and more resilient. And maybe it happens in one massive event. Maybe as a solar flare comes and wipes out 90% of the nodes and we have to try to start back from the 10% left over. But maybe it happens slowly. Maybe it happens as nodes just fall offline because people had to move their computers and they just decide not to boot them back up because, Jesus, the load was ridiculous. Or a hard drive, you know, as hard drives become corrupted or power outages wipe out computers one at a time until, inevitably, if we can't add new ones, the only end result. So we end up with 3, 2, and we're right back to where we started. It's that only 3% problem that inevitably builds to 400%. When we start down that path, there's no turning back. So sure, we could hard fork, risk the security of the entire network, set the precedent of just kicking the can down the road, and 2 megabyte blocks would not be detrimental right now. It wouldn't. But 5 years go by. We've had to hard fork 3 more times because high fees come in a matter of weeks after we've done it. We have to do it again and again because the scaling problem never ends. There is no point where we're like, oh, 1,000 transactions per second, finally we're done. It goes on forever. It's a 5-gallon bucket trying to carry the ocean. And if we allow ourselves to set that tiny systemic imbalance now, it will destroy everything meaningful about Bitcoin in 20 years. But hard times create strong code. This is where Bitcoin comes in. This is the story of Bitcoin. This is the 2 steps forward while the rest of the world takes 1 step back. While the financial system is falling to its own complacency, ignoring its own imbalances, suffering under the propping up of its own corruption and irresponsibility, believing that that cost doesn't ever have to be paid because, well, they avoided it the last 5 times. Of course they think that. Bitcoin will be there, thriving more and more off the collateral damage as the legacy system crumbles. And Bitcoin will be there to pick up those crumbs and rebuild them into a better, stronger, uncensorable global financial behemoth. And then we will flourish. There will be an explosion of wealth and prosperity, having solved the greatest systemic problem of our day. But eventually, we will become complacent. The next generation will believe those problems are relegated to the past, and where this new foundation didn't quite solve something or left just a tiny window cracked in the castle, it will grow, and we will do this all over again. 2 steps forward, 1 step back. So maybe our task this time around is to see how much we can prepare for, how strong we can build this foundation so that those 2 steps forward last as long as possible. I guess we'll close that out. I guess that's probably all I had to say. I love this idea, though. I love that Giacomo put this together. Did such a great job of kind of laying out that pattern into the internet, and technology itself. It's just such a cool discussion. I think it's so enlightening to look at things that way. I love those patterns that when you see them and when you understand them, they are literally everywhere. They're in the tiniest of places and in the greatest of places. And of course, thank you to Alex Svetsky. This is another brilliant piece in the Bitcoin Times Volume 3 here. So many good ones. We still haven't gotten all the way through this. What have we got so far? The Greatest Game by Jeff Booth. Now we got Giacomo's piece. And then we did Alex Svetsky's on Prometheus and Bitcoin. So much more to come. Don't forget that to share this out. If you want to support the show, I mean, obviously you can become a patron, you know, join the Audionauts, jump into the Sphinx chat tribe. There's still so much cool stuff going on with Lightning and everything. Set up an Umbral node. I'm still waiting on the hardware that I bought, and I'm so excited about getting that running. But they've got a one-click install for Sphinx. So if you want to jump into the tribe or you want to become a patron and jump into the Telegram group, both of those are where the Audionauts hang out. And it's a wonderful way to support the show. But obviously, if you don't want to, you know, send a couple of bucks my way, or you want to hang on to those sats, you want to hodl, the best way that you can always support this show for free is share it out. Tell your noob friends that are asking you about Bitcoin. Tell them to listen to the show. Send them this episode or whichever one is your favorite read. It does a lot, and it shows that you guys have been spreading this by word of mouth, because the listeners and downloads keep growing, and I've not really done anything other than just keep posting to my Twitter feed. So it's awesome. You guys are everything. Thank you so, so much. And of course, thank you to my sponsors. We've got the BitBox O2 hardware wallet. If your savings become worth 4 times, 10 times as much very quickly in Bitcoin during these times, you got to secure it with a safe, simple hardware wallet. BitBox is that. And of course, you know, if you want to really go all in and do Bitcoin banking services, Level.co, our other sponsor, is like, that's it. Like, they got a free exchange with no trading fees. Debit card, direct deposit, ACH wire transfer, the whole match. Really cool service. You can find both of these at guyswan.com, right at the front of the page, or top of the page. Thank you so much to them for supporting Bitcoin Audible. And thank you guys for listening. Bitcoin is the new system that will flourish in the dust of the old as it crumbles. And let's hold strong. Prepare and build and spread the word as fast as you can. It is our only option for a peaceful transition, and we are absolutely going to need it. Thank you guys for listening. I'm Guy Swan, and until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys. This has been a 111 production, and you were listening to Bitcoin Audible on the Crypto Economy Network.